Welcome back, Raw Thoughts listeners. My name is Mackenzie Tiggs. I bring on people throughout the community where we talk about their stories, see where their life has gone, and share experiences through that. Today, I have Brad Young with Get Safe coming onto the podcast and talking about a few different topics. He actually reached out to the podcast and said, hey, like, I have a story. I want to share what I've got going on. And we brought him on. So if you are like Brad and want to come on to the podcast, share your story, share your business, definitely reach out to me on social media. On my email is in the descriptions, and we'll get you on. So today, Brad, welcome on.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. Yeah. So let's talk about all about Brad.
Oh yeah, let's do that. It's my favorite thing to do. So where to start? I was born and raised in Oklahoma, town about the size of a nickel, like 300 to 400 people in it.
Wow.
And I left at 18, joined the military pre 9/11, and then basic training. The towers went down, and I spent the next 7 years in the Army. Doing, you know, Army stuff.
Yeah.
And it was a good, I had a enjoyable experience in the military. It's something that still connected, like I feel that stronger connection to my military background than I ever did my law enforcement background. But I got married, met a nice young lady when I was 19, and, you know, I've known her half my life at this point. We've been married for almost 19 years.
Wow.
Three kids. And I was looking at my third enlistment, and she looked at me and she's like, you need a real job. I said, I've got a job. And she's like, no, you need a real job. I was like what? She's like, you should be a cop. I said, no, I'm good on that. No, thank you. And I was like, nobody likes the cops. And she's like, well, nobody likes you either. It'll be a good fit.
Wow. Okay. What?
So it's a running joke in the house, but it was a good fit. So we moved to California, and I got hooked up with an agency out in Silicon Valley, and I spent the next 13 years doing police stuff in the California Bay Area. So I was a hostage negotiator, a canine handler, and a SRO for, I think, the biggest three things of my law enforcement career. Landed kind of in those spaces because those are the things that keep coming back up.
Right.
And then I lateraled to a new agency closer to home because the commute was a killer. And after about 18 months, I kind of just got burnt out and tired of law enforcement.
Yeah.
And which kind of put us where I'm at now is with Get Safe. And Get Safe, I actually took training from them when I was an active cop. And my background was kind of crisis intervention, suicide prevention. The city I worked for had a history of kids jumping in front of trains. And there was significant clusters throughout our careers, my partner and I. And it just kind of took a toll. And so I was like, how do we solve this problem? In 2017, I went to a train-the-trainer class, how to teach cops how to de-escalate, how to teach cops how to be crisis intervention officers. Because the 40-hour class is hard. It's not like hard, like labor intensive or mentally or physically. It's just long and kind of dry. And it's like, none of us are here to be clinicians. We're here to, you know, drive fast and, you know,
catch bad guys.
And what happened out of that is I met the instructors. We got to be pretty good friends. And not 3 days later, I got a phone call from a coworker, and he's like, hey, I have a friend at Travis Air Force Base. They are having a significant issue with suicide attempts and suicide ideation within their ranks. And can you put on a crisis intervention class for them? It's like, yeah, we can do that.
And this was specifically for the first responders.
Yeah, it was for the military police at this Air Force Base. And I forget the numbers because it's, you know, been a while, but they had marked reductions after these the personnel started going through this training and being able to recognize behavior, having the confidence to be able to have the tough conversations to address the issues that they were seeing, and then pull somebody out of an emotional crisis and ground them to a spot where they're willing to be a part of the solution themselves, because that's really how you get to that next point, is you got to have some advocacy in your own agency. So that from that, I called the people at Get Safe. It's like, you're not going to believe what just happened. I got this like freelance thing. I did it for free because I'm stupid and I don't know how to make any money. And
because you have a big heart and you're caring.
But you understand, you're a nonprofit. Yeah. And they laughed and they said, yeah, well, let's bring it in. Let's see what else you got. And I became a full-time trainer. We developed an 8-hour crisis intervention de-escalation training. This is like at the height of all of the unrest across the country. And it got certified in California and then eventually nationwide. And we were teaching all over the place. Like, I think we're over 7,500 officers just in California alone that have gone through our training. COVID hit, changed the dynamic. I took a break from teaching, but I kind of stayed involved in the development side of things and started developing video training, because we granted through UCLA. So UCLA had an extension where they were putting our training on. We'd have all these people come through this UCLA training.
Wow.
It was funny. I got to my new agency, and the captain walks up. He's like, hey, Brad, I saw you on my computer today. And I said, well, that's either good or bad based on my training and experience. That could go either way.
Right.
And he goes, no, I took the UCLA class, and now we want you to develop in-house training for us. I said, great, let's do it. So then we put together a series of, you know, basically how to talk to people. Now, I can't go ahead.
So I have a question. How were these agencies going through UCLA? Like, what did that look like? How did that come about, I guess, just to help the listeners and help me understand that part?
Well, it comes at a price that most government agencies enjoy, which is free. And that's they advertised it. They said, we're offering this course. It would go out in emailers and flyers. And
they would go out to different agencies.
They would just sign up and register, and they'd be in the class.
Wow.
And there's requirements. Like, you know, Zoom is kind of a iCross piece. There were synchronous and asynchronous pieces, so you could, or otherwise, for people that I didn't know what that meant, self-paced and then instructor-led.
Okay.
And they would register and they'd go through the classwork. And because it's kind of like more videos, you keep your camera on. That way the instructor's engaged with you and they can say, hey, you need to answer this question. What was I just talking about?
Right. The interaction piece of it.
And that was how all of that like started to, how our numbers jumped. We were all over the state, but now we're like, have the potential to go all over the country.
Right.
And leaving law enforcement, I called my boss and I'm like, hey man, I'm done. I need something to do with my time. And he goes, okay, I need somebody to help bring us out of this market and into new markets outside of California. I said, okay, let's look and see what we got. So I came in and we started really pushing all of our coursework. We have, you know, a bunch of courses for law enforcement. Now, if I'm just pause just a second to talk about Get Safe, because it is a great organization. Get Safe is a three-pieced organization. One piece is focused on training, empowering, equipping, and advocating for those with an intellectual developmental disability or another type of disability, to whether that is how to live a neurotypical lifestyle, or just they get wrapped up in the justice system and they need an advocate, or they have court-mandated trainings to help process information and how to handle different situations. That's one part.
Okay.
Our second part is corporate and community. So we do a lot of community advocacy. We do a lot of, the boss used to do self-defense training and with crime survivors. So you would get mostly women coming in after they've been victimized in some sort of crime, and we're putting power back in their hands by teaching them how to defend themselves, recognizing sketchy behavior that can lead to trouble.
Yeah.
And then he started recognizing, like, you know, cops, he's an Orange County deputy, reserve deputy. He's like, you know, they're not getting training and working with persons with autism. Like, they don't understand, like, you know, stimming and echolalia and all the things that come with somebody with on the spectrum. Let's develop that. And so he developed that and insert where we are today. So now we have a bunch of these different things. Like, they do FTO in California. They all three different updates. They do a course for dispatchers, how to resolve crisis in the call center. They do, which just on dispatchers alone, my goodness, the men and women that work in a call center, the 911 calls that don't make it through to the board,
right,
are just the things that they have to endure, and just the bad words and the harsh language and
And I will say sometimes the stupidity.
I wasn't going to say that, but I'm glad somebody did.
I will. I've listened to enough. I mean, my mom was a 911 dispatcher. I grew up listening to community calling in, and it's like, you don't know what you don't know, but sometimes, I'm sorry, but it's just plain stupid.
911, what's the address to your emergency? Oh my gosh. Where are you at? We can't get to you until we know where you are. Yeah. Where are you? You know what? I don't like your attitude.
Yep.
And hang up. Oh, well.
Yeah.
Now what? But so we developed a course for them with dispatchers on our instructor pool, and they're the ones that teach it. So you have subject matter experts that are actually engaging and teaching these classes. And then we have the basics, the working with persons with disabilities. We have basic de-escalation for patrol. We have basic community policing, implicit bias, and racial profiling, the things that are more mandatory classes that are relevant to just better understanding how to problem solve in each individual community. And we have this program called Bridge the Divide, where we have communities. We bring them in the morning, and we have a conversation like, this is what crisis intervention training looks like 4 hours down and dirty, personal safety, how to have increased emotional intelligence, how to have hard conversations with coworkers, people on the street, whatever. And in the afternoon, we bring in the cops. And now we explain what it looks like to be the police, what to expect from the police, and then facilitate discussions with what are your expectations as the public, and what are the realities of meeting those expectations as that law enforcement entity tasked with serving that community.
How did those go?
Well, we did it twice last month in Mendocino County.
Where is that at?
It's north of San Francisco.
Okay.
So there's a town called Fort Bragg, and that one went great. It was real easy, nothing too complicated. Everybody's like, we love the police. And then we went to Ukiah. And you can Google it. I'm not going to get into their dirt and their drama, but they've had some. And the community's like, this is not going to go well for them. We're here to, like,
you know. Bash them.
Yeah. And you know what? At the end of the day, I was impressed at the maturity and the responsibility on both sides that were taken in the conversation and facilitating that healing process to build legitimacy and trust between the two entities, which is what community-oriented policing is.
Right.
And so we do that with Bridge the Divide. So it's pretty stock and standard, but it, like, for instance, if they were to say, here in Boise, we want this to happen, we would do it, and it would just be more tailored to this community versus, you know, Ukiah, California, where nobody's ever heard of.
Right.
Outside of.
Well, because each community has their own kind of culture and standards and expectations, you know, different than, you know, a different county. Even Ada County versus Kearney County is going to be completely different, you know, in the Treasure Valley of what that looks like for policing.
Absolutely. And you know, as you transition from the coasts inward, the culture changes, the attitudes change, everything changes.
Right.
So, you know, you have areas of the country that are very anti-police, and other areas of the country where they're very pro-police, and both sides are on each end of the spectrum. And I think both are kind of have the potential to have some fallacy in that belief system.
Right.
there are mistakes that can be made. It's okay to make mistakes. Just acknowledge them and move on.
Right.
Versus just like, But now that leads me to my favorite class because I helped develop it. As a school resource officer in a community that was had a lot of suicide with our kids, a lot in general, but mostly the ones that with the kids are the ones that stick with you. My partner and I walked into this position, the SRO position, mid-year. So we had a 3.5-year term. The guys that were before us, one retired and one opted out. He's like, I'm done with this. The guy before him was Mr. Popular. He was high fives, super gregarious, just whatever you need, I'm your guy.
Right.
The variance in the two were like, now we don't know what we want. We don't know what we're going to get. So we came in with a different attitude. We looked at some, we did some reading. We did some like fact finding, like what's a really good way to do these things? And if I could recommend a book, it's called The Like Switch by Dr. Jack Schaefer. And he talks about how to build rapport environmentally. And so we tried it. And at first, you know, you get on campus and they're like, why are you here? Why is there a gun on campus? Which is totally different than the vibe you kind of see here. Right.
Right. Now, is this the faculty? Is this the students themselves? Like kind of questioning the guns on campus? Who is that questioning it?
All of the above.
Okay.
Including parents.
Okay.
And school board. And this isn't a new program. This is a program that's been around for years.
Yeah.
Well, was around. It's no longer around. Anyways, we would show up and then be like, what are you? And we wore soft uniforms. So very similar to what I'm wearing today, like khaki pants, right, black polo shirt, to be approachable. But at the end of the day, we're still cops. We still have a job to do. And, you know, in all fairness, most of our work was CIT work, 5150s with kids, which 5150 is the California Welfare Institution Code for danger to self, danger to others, or gravely disabled as a result of a mental illness. So, in other words, if somebody is suicidal, they would generally get taken to the hospital. But if somebody was, you know, schizophrenic, not necessarily, unless they were doing something or there was something in their behavior as a result of that schizophrenia that was causing them to be a danger, would they go to the hospital? Is that?
Yeah.
So, we're in a school setting. Safety is paramount. It's the biggest thing. And this is an interesting school because my first year as a cop in this town, we get a man with a gun on campus. Some knucklehead brought his AK-47 airsoft gun home from or back to school after lunch and was carrying it like he was driving to this Baghdad. And in the front seat of the car, got called in. School goes on lockdown. We, you know, end up finding the car, breaking out the windows, seeing it's BB gun or airsoft gun, kind of diminishes everything. But at the end of the day, that's what we dealt with. Now, fast forward. We're, as an SRO, we got these threats to schools often. And I really don't know what it was. They really never manifested into anything. It was, we would get a anonymous tip via this Facebook page that the school runs, that's student driven, that there's going to be a kid with a gun on campus tomorrow. And so, you know, we get the call at 9 o'clock at night. We're in the office working all through the night trying to figure out who, what, when, what the, you know, everything. And one of the bigger ones is we found the kid, set up a plan, went in, knocked on his door, or his mom and dad's door at like 3 or 4 a.m. So we're running out of time. So it was like school starts at 0 hours, like at 7. So we're hustling. And mom and dad, like, what is going on? Like, you need to come outside. I'm going to tell you what's going on. This is what's happening. Where's your kid? What's happening? So they're like, oh, yeah, he's in his room. Please go help. Snuck in, and he happened to be sleeping with his hands over his head, like leaned against the his bunk bed. Grabbed his hands and slapped handcuffs off before he could wake up. And sure enough, he had a replica Glock in his closet and like a manifesto. And there's something that we need to recognize is that there's a very fine line between suicide and homicide. Somebody that's willing to take their own life can also be very willing to take somebody else's life.
Right.
So a lot of this, you look at how much of it is I'm intending to do harm and how much of it is I just want this to end and therefore I'm going to create a problem that somebody else is going to solve.
Right.
But these kind of things happened from time to time. One of the last ones, it was such a crazy week. We had a kid get snatched off of a running trail during PE. And she was safe. We went out and we're looking for evidence of everything that had happened. And while we're walking, the place had backed up to like where Tesla's headquarters was. So it's like kind of wooded. We had parked in the Tesla parking lot, which is a puzzle in and of itself to get in and out of. And we're sitting there and all of a sudden my phone rings. I'm like, hello? And it's the principal at school. It's like, we just got a threat. And we have got 5 minutes to get the school locked down because that's when they said it's going to start. So we basically put the school in lockdown and everybody's rushing this whole big thing. It ended up being like a hoax. But in the moment, nobody knew it was a hoax.
Nobody knows, and you have to prepare yourself for the worst, you know, because it's going to be that time where, you know, you get that tip, you get that notification, and you don't do anything about it, and then it is when that harm comes through.
Yeah.
So going back to the story about the kid with, you know, the Facebook post, those kinds of things, yes, he had a gun in there. Like, did you end up finding the motivation? I mean, was that his motivation? Like, what, you know?
His motivation, like, and I was trying to be elusive kind of with the answer, but it was self-harming behavior. His idea was, I'm going to scare these people, the cops are going to show up, and I'm going to brandish the gun at them, and they're not going to be able to tell it's fake.
Right.
So through conversation, that's kind of the idea we got to. So versus it was something more nefarious, it was just more, I need you to kill me for me.
Right.
And
you did talk about that, about, you know, the fine line between homicide and suicidal, and how many people do, you know, it's easier for them to say, oh, you know, that person got killed by the police, but really the motivation was they didn't want to do it themselves. And they wanted to put, you know, the power not in them, but in somebody else to take their lives, you know. And that's more and more and more, you know, not about the county that you're in, just nationally.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, I can speak to California numbers because I did, during the research for some of our programs, this is one of the things that come up is you take an academy graduate, brand new, and then you add the first two cycles of mandatory training, the continual professional training, the things that are perishable skills. And that's a 5-year period total. And that includes field training. 50% is, and when it, let me back that up. The breakdown for the amount of training given in dealing with people, 50% is firearms. About 43% is defensive tactics, arrest and control. So that's how to put handcuffs on somebody, how to arm bars, twist locks, all of the, you know, the high speed, fancy, like snatch and grab and secure. And only 6-7% are based in communication. And that's a really rough estimate. Now, using those numbers, every time I get out of my car, I generally have to communicate with somebody. And the amount of time I pull my gun on somebody or have to fight somebody is significantly less than the amount of time I have to talk to them. So there's such a little emphasis on how to talk to people and a huge emphasis on how to address the threat. Where's the recognition of what threatening behavior looks like? The decision-making process. What are we doing to ensure that our public safety are serving the safety of the public, and just having that recognition to it. So that's kind of what it all boils down to. Like, there's a need for firearm training. There's a need for defensive tactics, but there's also a huge need for communication, because it's often under, people don't realize how little they know about how to talk to somebody.
Right.
And to transition into the crisis intervention piece of things, when I was in the Bay Area, I was one of the academy instructors or guest instructors for the CIT class, the 40-hour just bang your head against the wall because it's so long class. And it's, you have all these brand new recruits and none of them have any life experience. And they don't like asking hard and tough questions. And, you know, hold up my finger guns and it's empty. There's nothing in it. As you can see, nobody's going to get hurt. Now, if I pointed at you and I tell you I'm here to help you, what are you going to believe, my words or my actions?
Your actions, absolutely.
Right? Now, I'd also ask them this. If somebody is suicidal, do they want to hurt themselves or do they want to kill themselves? And they're like, oh, you know, it, you get kind of a mixed bag on that. But the reality is, if somebody is suicidal, death is a solution to the problem.
Right.
Not the problem.
Right.
So you have to get comfortable saying, do you want to kill yourself? And that's a, and I've seen enough of the old veteran cops ask, do you want to hurt yourself? You're not asking the right questions.
Right.
You got to ask the right questions to get the right answers.
And it's, I mean, especially with my history of being a paramedic as well, nobody wants to ask even, are you suicidal? Are you thinking about it? Do you have a plan? What is your plan? You know, digging deeper into those questions. And like you said, asking those hard questions, you know, and hurting yourself is so far different than wanting to kill yourself, you know, and there is a spectrum too of hurting yourself. Is it you just want to, you know, kind of take away your thoughts and so you're going to cut yourself and that's going to deflect your, you know, kind of thoughts that you have going on? Is it that you want to hurt yourself so bad that you do die?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's so many different things in that communication piece. You know, I taught our first responders a lot, like, you have to ask them, do you want to kill yourself? And it's, saying those words are very difficult and it's not fun, but it has to be done.
That's why we get paid the big bucks.
I wish.
You got to ask the tough questions nobody wants to ask. Also, nobody wants to go into the bank that's being robbed. Nobody wants to do, you know, throw out the stop sticks on the high-speed car pursuit. There's a lot of inherent danger that boils down to calculated risk.
Mm-hmm.
There's really no risk in asking that. Hey, do you want to kill yourself? And if the answer is no, the answer is always going to be no.
Mm-hmm.
And if the answer is yes, well, now you have something else to work with. And that is, like, it, if you robbed a bank, I wouldn't ask you necessarily, do you know how fast you're going? That's the wrong question.
Right.
The right questions have everything to do with what's going on presently, but not, do you know how fast you're going? That's silly, but it's easier to ask.
Yeah. And it's a comfortability thing too. It's, you know, kind of like checking your boxes. You're like, oh, no, I said it. You know, I did my thing.
You said check the box, not me. I was trying not to say that today. Because that's what law enforcement training is a lot of times, is check the box for liability. If I check the box and say we go through this, 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 and this, look, we were trained. Did any training occur?
Probably not.
But it says you did. Yeah. You're accountable for it now. But did any training occur? What learning was taken away from this? Well, this is why I like Get Safe. It's because there is training. There are PowerPoint slides. It's kind of difficult to get through 4 hours without something visually stimulating to look at, but it's also interactive. It's discussion-based. I'm learning from you, you're learning from him, and he's learning from me. So at the end, you have this big group learning session that's being facilitated and directed by an instructor. Something that's unique about it is generally, because of our ties to the community and our comeuppance, is that we offer a community perspective as an instructor. So our director of training is actually a community member. So he will come in and say, well, this is what happened, or this is this concept. I'm going to let you know what I hear when we teach the community side of things. Because every time we teach to the cops are always like, well, who's telling the community this?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we are, because we're also doing the same thing with them. And so you have two sides of the same coin represented in each of these courses, which allows for a wider and broader perspective. Our motto is changing mindsets to change outcomes. So if you want to think of it in tactical terms, if I'm going to search a building and I have to look down a hallway, I take a step back and I can still use that wall for cover, but I can see more the further I get away from the wall backwards. And it's like I slice the pie and make myself see a little bit more with each slice. It's the same concept. I'm just changing my perspective to increase what is in front of me. And the more information we have, the safer we are.
Right.
And we get to go home at the end of the day. But hopefully, so does everybody else that's supposed to go home.
Right.
At the end of the day.
Yeah, absolutely. How do people, I mean, how are you getting this to the communities? Like, say Boise didn't want to put this on. Like, what does that look like reaching out to Get Safe? What does that look like getting the information to the cities, to the, you know, you have to also get your police officers on board with this. Like, how are you integrating this?
That is, so right now, what we're doing is a couple of different options. We, you know, we have the digital landscape. We have the Instagram and the Facebook and the LinkedIn and the website, which people can search and it comes up. We get put in different mailers depending on the training agency with our nationally certified courses, which is one of the ones that I was telling you about is our Youth in Crisis course. Because of our experiences in SRO, because we've dealt with the emotional side of kids, you know, kids are try to be tender with this, but they're emotionally incompetent yet feelings driven.
Right.
So everything is emotion. They just don't understand them. It's just the way their brain develops. It's overactive in the feelings department. So our youth course is nationally certified, and it's actually the one that I'm pushing because that's the one I helped develop. That's my favorite class. So we talk about recognizing behaviors and how to have conversations and how to pull information and how to build rapport and trust, and because it's relationships that solve problems. Every one of these mass violence assailants at a school, or really anywhere, but most of we'll talk about schools, at some point leaked intent. Somebody knew.
Mm-hmm.
No one's ever really surprised by who it is. So by building relationships with the kids in the school, they're the ones that are going to tell, this is what's going on, and we should know about that. So to answer your question, how are we doing that? It's mostly digital marketing at this point. And then we are also doing things like this, coming on a show like yours to talk about it, because we have partnered with a company in Florida, Coal Engineering. And Coal Engineering, most people probably haven't heard of it because they do a lot of government virtual training. So they have a computer platform that looks a lot like Fortnite, where they drop the participants into the virtual environment with their roles that they get paid to do on a daily basis. So if I'm a cop, I'm a cop. If I'm a fireman, I'm a fireman. I'm a dispatcher, I'm dispatching. If I'm a teacher, I'm a teacher. And if I'm a paramedic, I got to go do paramedic stuff. And they present them a scenario that's happening at a school. And this company is incredible. This first responder sandbox, what they call it, this platform is awesome, because you can design your own scenarios. So like, well, we have this, but we want to do a custody gone wrong, or we want to do a stranger danger at the school. Like, how do we solve these problems from these different perspectives? Well, we partnered with them. So we are putting our 4 hours of our advanced crisis intervention, youth in crisis, on the front end of the training day to prevent. It's the prevention model. And we go to lunch, and then we come back, and they offer their sandbox, and they administer the scenarios with all of the participants. So we want schools, we want firemen, we want EMS, we want police and dispatch in the room so that they all get to use this multidisciplined, unified command structure and dealing with these problems. And here's the thing. It's cost effective because the sandbox platform is free. It's cost effective because it doesn't traumatize any kids going through these things. It doesn't traumatize any teachers going through these things. You can make mistakes because it's virtual and it doesn't really hurt anything.
Right.
You get to learn and practice all of these. And you're like, Smith, why did you do that? He's like, oh, I didn't. Okay. Click, 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 click. You back up. You watch the bird's eye view, which is a live after action review. And you can go through and see, well, there you are, Smith. You're doing the thing that we told you not to do. How come you did that? I wasn't thinking. Or my finger slipped. Well, now you need to own your mistake and move forward.
Right. It's a learning aspect.
So we're bringing learning into the process. And because it's a multidisciplined room, we have the different levels of training, recognizing troubling behavior. How does bullying contribute to all of this? How to at least be aware and acknowledge your biases when you're doing assessments. How to have hard conversations, all of the above, right? And so that's the prevention model, which is harder to sell than it is anything else. If you look at school safety is a multi-billion dollar industry, but it's all response driven. It's all depending on the next one.
Mm-hmm.
Buy this lock, it'll keep your door shut. Buy this alarm system, it'll keep your first alert type of stuff, which is great. But we should also be investing into prevention.
Right.
How do you quantify prevention? You really can't until you've got years of data to look back on and take a bird's eye view and say, well, in this year we had these many incidents. We implemented the prevention model here, and now 10 years later we can see that we had a steady decline.
Right.
Which is what the Coast Guard did with life jackets. They said, well, look at all these deaths that could have been prevented. Implementation of life jackets, and now we just have a steady decrease of drowning deaths every year because they have a preventative model.
Right.
Get Safe is the life jacket. The first responder sandbox is the person jumping in to help you swim. So that's the product. What we're trying to do is we're offering it free here in Treasure Valley because we want it here. We want to start here. It gets us out of California. Gets closer to home. Brings Florida to the middle, brings the West Coast kind of to the mountains. And then we're just looking for an agency, school, firemen, firewomen, not sure what the right term is, to participate. So it doesn't even have to be from the same agency. We'll take 2 to 3 from each discipline and say, hey, come in, get a free day's worth of training.
Does this training go to, can they get any of their hours towards their actual, because it is certified, they could actually use this?
So for the law enforcement, the answer is yes. This is a certified course through IATLIST, which is here actually in Treasure Valley too. It's headquartered in Eagle, and they are a certifying agency that takes the content, they vet it through a third party as best practices, and then give it their stamp of approval. Because it's a certified through them, law enforcement agencies here get credit for it for their
continuing education. Yeah.
I don't know how firemen and EMS work because that's,
there's different hours for each of those for your certification that you can use for continuing ed. And I would assume probably if it's for law enforcement, you could probably easily get it for fire and EMS for their...
It seems to be looser standards as far as the certification stuff. We went to Utah and trained a bunch of dispatchers, and it wasn't certified nationally, but because Utah recognized somebody else's post-certification, they gave all of the dispatchers credit for the training that they took.
Okay.
So
when you bring all these people together, okay, so give an example of maybe where you have people from EMS, you have people from, you know, fire, you have the kids, they come in, like, what would that day really look like? Like, this sandbox, you know, you talk about this platform, they would be doing their roles, but, like, how are they communicating on this platform? How are they talking? How are they running these scenarios all together?
That's a good question. I'm going to do my best to answer it as best I can, because I'm not associated with Edge or coal engineering outside of this thing. But from what I've seen is you open up a computer, they say, this goes forward, backwards, this is the function key, this is how you operate your stuff, and this is how you play a video game.
Okay.
And then they give you a headset with a microphone, and it's got stereo in it. So, because I know, like, with at least in my experiences, a lot of times firefighters have different radios going off depending on the size of the organization and what sectors they're working or what's right. going on. So you can put you'll hear something in this year and something in this year, and then you'll have you're communicating, like, well, what did you see? Like, there's a great video that you can go online to YouTube and type in Edge FRS and see all of the stuff that they do. But they have you walk in, I'm Officer Young. I was dispatched here, and you're talking to a school official, like, well, what did you see? And the teacher is talking through their headset on their screen. I was walking down the hallway and I heard gunshots. And can you tell me how to get there? And they tell the officer how to get there. I'm going to wait on my cover unit. The cover unit shows up and you go down together and then you open, like, you have to solve the problem. Like, and it's not like a math problem. It's like a legitimate problem. You have to open the door. You have to, like, search and scan and do these things. You have force options, handcuffs, pepper spray, taser, firearm. And then if somebody's hurt, the cops, the fire, and the EMS have the option to triage and provide first aid. So if there's multiple injuries, you have to triage and see which one's the most significant and fix that one first. And then so everybody's communicating on their whatever channel they're plugged into. Dispatchers dispatching. They're taking the information. Units be advised. This is what we're dealing with at this place. And
who is this, I guess, and maybe you don't know this answer, but how is it not going to everybody's headsets? Like, is it, like EMS only hears their dispatch, you know, on that one head or the one side that you were talking about?
So think of it in terms of like a call center. Your dispatchers have access to multiple channels. There's like, so I was thinking back to like when I was in the Bay Area, we had multiple dispatchers at the same time, right? And one would work police primary, one would work secondary police, one would work fire and paramedics, and one would work like utilities. So if you have two dispatchers, they're dealing with similar problems and dispatching just like they would in a call center.
What I'm saying though, and maybe I didn't explain this right, but like how is that like the students don't hear on their headphones what dispatch is saying to fire and EMS in there? Like,
so we're, as of right now, we're not including students in the training, but they have to be plugged into the radio channel. So like the teachers, for example, instead of students, they're not hearing any of that because they don't have a radio. They're not equipped with one.
Right.
They might have a school radio. So they're talking to the officer, the SRO, that also has a school radio, but it's not an encrypted broadband, like police, fire,
no, that
channel. So like you only get what you have in real life.
Right. I guess what I'm, maybe I'm not explaining it right, but like if you're all in the same room.
Oh, because you have your headphones on.
Yeah, because you have your headphones on. Like, how is the teacher not hearing, you know, when the dispatcher is trying to tell fire and EMS what needs to be happening, that it doesn't come through their headset, like, in this scenario, in this platform, not in real life. Yeah.
So in the scenario, everybody has plugged into whatever channel they're listening to.
Okay, so it is still a channel system.
It is still a channel system. Now, there is probably some bleed over because we're sitting next to each other and you hear me say these things. But if there's anything you take away is, even though it's a video game, people still get pulled in.
Oh, yeah.
And so they're not paying attention. They're focused on what's in front of them. Think about the last time you played Mario Kart and, like, you cut the guy off and just, you know, got first.
Right.
And, you know, you're emotionally involved. Same as similar to this. Now, we, I don't know, and I can't speak to every teacher in the world, but of all the teachers I've ever run across, a majority of them aren't interested in being gunfighters. This is the concept of school safety is incredibly scary and sometimes traumatic to even consider versus just having conversations.
Right.
That's why run, hide, fight is very akin to what you do naturally. Fight, flight, or freeze.
Right. Right?
So when we're putting this kind of thing in front of them, it's scary. So it's not scary in terms of like reality, but like it's emotionally charged. So they're invested into what's happening. And most of the time that's going to cause auditory exclusion and they're going to hear what they're going to hear and they're not going to hear anything else.
Okay. Yeah. That was just out of, I guess, questioning, you know, how the platform actually works. How do you see this being, I mean, I know a lot of agencies locally will do like actual in-person scenarios. How do you think this is going to compare, because it is, you know, I'm going to say a video game, mm-hmm. versus that true instinct of, you know, kids actually playing the role, you know, you actually physically seeing somebody hurt, knowing what to do versus this video game?
So now looking at information that we have, we know that a majority of all violence that happens at a school is perpetrated by somebody that has connection to a school. And if we're going to run drills on how to respond to, prevent, that it will include policies and procedures for when it happens, does it make sense to you to include the people that might be involved in it? So if I got a high school full of kids, and the probability of one of them being the assailant, why would I show them all the cards in my hand? So we're teaching the adults how to be adults and to think like adults, so that when the time happens, they can lead the children.
Right. And do you not feel like that happens when they like actually do simulations of that in real life?
Well, the kids aren't involved in the training. It's adults.
There's locally. There's
right. No, I'm talking for us specifically. Right. We're not training the kids. Yeah, sure. There's anytime you bring a kid into it, you're gonna have like they're gonna talk about it because they talk about everything. We've done live events at a school, but we waited till all the kids left and then we ran it without them.
Right.
We used to do lockdown drills and the thing is like kids need to feel safe at school. There is a direct correlation between feeling safe at school and learning. If they feel safe, they're more apt to learn. If they feel like they're not safe, that's a distraction that prevents learning. We have kids today, well, all of our kids today, have never grown up without a smartphone. They've never grown up without terrorism in the news every day. They've never grown up without a war happening somewhere that we were involved in. They've never done these things. There's just so much information that our kids is just inundated them with. That, especially when we start talking about school safety, school's not a safe place to, doesn't feel like a safe place to be anymore. So what kind of learning is happening?
Right.
So and this is just my opinion. I'm not speaking on behalf of anybody at this point, but we should be doing a really, taking concentrated efforts in making sure that our kids go to school to do what they're supposed to do at school, become educated, and then move on to the next phase of their life.
Right.
We're trying to equip them for the road, and we're trying to set them up for success. And if they're just constantly reminded that there is danger that lurks in the shadows, that's not really any way to live your life. There's a risk in everything, but people don't realize that risk until you make it aware.
Yeah.
And it's being aware that is terrifying.
Right. I mean, the fear that is instilled, and I'm going to say all over, you know, in every human is far greater than even what I remember growing up with. You know, that's why people are like, do you watch the news? I'm like, no, I don't watch the news. They're like, not at all. I'm like, no, I don't watch the news. It's not because I'm being naive. It's because it's literally everywhere, and there's good things and bad things that happen all over the time. The news just wants to promote the bad things all the time, you know?
That sells.
Yeah.
Fear is a motivator to sell things. I mentioned earlier that the school safety industry is a multi-billion dollar industry. But, you know, like, just let me ask you this. Since Columbine, which was like the first big one that I can remember, mm-hmm. aside from law enforcement tactics, what have we done differently in our school system to change? Where is that money going?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I've been out of school for a long time, but the locks and, mm-hmm. you know, how many, I know quite a few teachers that, you know, now they have to continue through the day, have their doors locked, and all of those locking systems and all of the alarm systems, like you had said. I mean, that is definitely, you know, something that is being paid for, but then you also need, you know, at times too. So it's kind of a double-edged sword where it's like, yes, it's needed, but we're also making money off of it.
Yeah. Well, and I can sell more gadgets if I make you feel like it's the only way to make you feel safe.
Right.
So on that note, being able to recognize symptomology, signs and behaviors that are indicative of feeling a certain way, then I can equip you with, I'm gonna teach you how to pull that information out of that person so that you can be a part of the resolution instead of the response.
Right.
Because we want to build people up. We want to encourage them. Now, this isn't an absolute. There's no such thing as absolutes when we're talking about people, except that they pay taxes and they die. And some of them don't pay taxes.
I was going to say, even paying taxes is sometimes not always true. We're humans. We have so many different variables. We have so many different, you know, aspects to us.
You know, everybody encourages empathy a lot and compassion, which they're great. I have no qualms about how great empathy and compassion are. But how many people are actually utilizing empathetic methods or compassionate methods in helping those around them?
Not very many,
because it's very me-centric.
Yes,
we all look at our phones all day long, constantly. Mm-hmm. And who are we worried about?
It's always ourselves.
So how do I become empathetic with those around me and bear their burdens and help bring them into like a solution if I'm so focused on me?
Right. And it's hard because, you know, a lot of people, you know, currently we do have to be, you know, I guess I will say this to this aspect. We do have to be aware of ourselves, and we do have to be, you know, very self-conscious, because at the end of the day, we do have ourselves. But at the same time, benefiting, hurting other people so that you are better yourself is only hurting everyone.
Yeah.
It's hurting yourself. It's hurting the people that you're doing this to. And that definitely, you know, is very self-sabotaging, you know, in many different ways. I want to go back to you talking about, and I think this is just very heavy on my heart recently, with the teen suicide prevention.
Mm-hmm.
How is Get Safe, you know, doing these trainings? How are we helping prevent? How are we helping teach these teens? Because they are so emotionally driven. Then you come in with the world of fear. Then you come in with lack of, you know, emotional intelligence from the parents.
Mm-hmm.
And then the teacher. I mean, it's just like literally everything stacking on top of one another. I don't have kids. I don't have a husband, you know, but like there's always been a passion of mine within first responder mental health, suicide prevention, but it's the continuous struggle that, you know, we are seeing the numbers within teens continue to rise and continue to rise and continue to rise. And you talk about the life jacket, right? Helping prevent, you know, helping save those lives and have a decrease. How do we pull that into our teens and teaching them and teaching the people that are in their world how to see signs, how to understand that?
So it's not out yet, but we do have a packet within the same realm for parents and community groups so that we have, because, you know, and I hate to say it, but I feel like our generation is doing a really mediocre job in, like, addressing the needs of those coming up below us. And I only say that just from what I've seen, right? So there's a lot of, you know, a good spanking would fix that problem. Yeah, sometimes. Or you get to the heart of the problem and figure out what the issue is. And trauma begets trauma. If I'm carrying baggage, I'm going to carry that in, and my kid's going to take my baggage, and they're going to take their own baggage, and yada, yada, yada. So what I encourage is to be able to recognize what baseline behavior is in your kid. How does your kid normally act? Now, there will be fluctuation as they, you know, go through puberty and they develop and they become young adults. The moody broody attitude of teenage kids. But they have a baseline, and you should know better than anybody else what their baseline is, because they live with you.
Right.
Or they're yours. When that there's a deviation from that baseline, you should be asking what's going on. You should start looking, and there's all sorts of books out there, but recognizing the major emotions. I think there's 7 universal emotions: joy, fear, sadness. I'm failing the other 3.
Yeah.
But being able to see what those look like, the nonverbals, and say, hey, you look kind of sad. You seem kind of sad. Are you okay? Or they might respond back with, I'm not sad, or I'm not mad. Okay, that's fair, but this is what I'm seeing. And articulate the objective signs and symptoms. You're looking down, you're breathing kind of slow and heavy, your eyes are a little bit droopy, you kind of have this downward frown look on your face. You have these different things that I'm just saying are objective that I see in all the people that are sad. That's why I asked.
Right.
How are you? And then they may not even realize it, but by helping guide them into recognizing what those feelings are, you open the door to possibilities to explore what that emotion is and why they feel it. So for parents and teens, like, kids are kids, and they've always been kids. There's all kids are generally, like, the thing that changes is the adults and how they view the kids, right? And technology and the world around them, but people develop the same, they've developed the same.
Right.
And so we have to be better at recognizing things and pulling it out of them.
Right.
So, and you know, as a parent, it's really hard sometimes when my kid's in crisis. I got to remember it's not mine; it's theirs, and that way I can stay grounded and help guide them through it versus
reacting to it. What they're, you know, describing and telling you, and maybe sometimes not telling you at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely, you know, one of those things that's, you know, like I said, definitely heavy on the heart with doing, you know, the teen suicide prevention at Columbia High School. I mean, even just through, you know, social media, how many parents, how many, you know, just community members reached out. So there is a need. You know, you talk about you seeing a need, you seeing, you know, something that you need to be more preventative on, and that's just something that I continue to see developing over time.
I used a 2-prong approach when assessing, and it was pressure and isolation. So you can have either or, but when you have both, you've got problems. And isolation could be actual or perceived. And with the technology the way it is, a lot of times it's actual. Like, I know all of these people, but I know none of them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to talk to them. I don't have no feeling of connection, so I feel isolated.
Right.
I don't feel like I can talk to my mom, my dad, my brother, my sister, my aunt, my uncle, grandma, grandpa, whatever. I'm isolated. The other one is pressure. Am I who they want me to be? Mom and dad want me to do this. I want to do this. My boyfriend, girlfriend want me to do this. I'm not cutting the mustard. So if you have this pressure to be something that you're not connecting with, you're not identifying with, have this isolative behavior, you have the recipe for catastrophe.
Right.
And if I can articulate those 2 things generally, you're going to the hospital.
Yeah. Yeah. There's definitely definitely a lot of that. Idaho is very far behind on preventative and solution based.
We would love to help.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Well, as we wrap up, this has been a great conversation, and thank you so much for coming on and discussing Get Safe. How can people find you? How can people learn more about it? How can people get involved with this? What does that look like?
So the basics, the website, www.getsafeusa.com. Then all of our socials follow that trend of Get Safe. And then our law enforcement training Instagram is Get Safe LE Training. And then if you have any comments, questions, concerns, feedback, criticisms, whatever, you can send them to me at Brad, B-R-A-D, at GetSafeUSA.com, and I will gladly read them.
Cool. Awesome. Well, listeners, thank you again for listening for another week. Very excited to announce that episode 30. So this has been going on for 30 weeks. This is the most consistent I've ever been in anything besides change. So thank you again for yet another week, another guest, another story. Being able to hear this is amazing, and getting involved with that. So thank you again, Brad. Absolutely. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And yes, thanks again, listeners. And we'll see you next week for another one. Bye, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you for tuning into the show today. Your feedback is very important to me. If you could leave a review, as well as follow me on Instagram at rawthoughts.podcast, and email in at m.rawthoughts@gmail.com if you have any guest suggestions.